Good evening to you. My name is Oliver Norville, and it is now time for Mental Health Matters, brought to you this week with the kind compliments of Lewis Pharmacy. As we say, a special and wonderful good afternoon to our host, Tessa Chatterton-Shaw. Good evening to you, ma'am. How are you doing today?
I'm well, Oliver. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you, too. I know a lot of people are talking about your program.
Well, you know, that warms my heart. It really warms my heart. The program is great, gaining great traction across the world, might I add. I've received a lot of positive feedback, and even reflecting on last Sunday's program, several people have asked me to continue to discuss the difficult subject matter of suicide. So, Dr. McLaughlin, just let me prepare you. But welcome to our listeners in Barbados and across the world. And thanks to VOB and to Lewis Drug Mart for sponsoring this program. So, Oliver, do I go straight right in, or you have
Straight into it, ma'am. I know a lot of people have been eagerly anticipating the second part of your program.
Okay. So it really gives me distinct pleasure to introduce today's guest. And it's a special kind of guest because I actually knew his mother before I knew him. The late Eileen McLaughlin, Dr. McLaughlin. We were both directors of Drug Council, she in St. Kitts and Nevis, and I here in Barbados. So, like, Dr. McLaughlin feels like part of my family. So, welcome, Dr. McLaughlin. I am pleased that you have taken this time on a Sunday afternoon to share with us. You are the senior consultant psychiatrist at the psychiatric hospital. I'm going to allow you to say a few things first, but just let me read your bio. And listeners, I have to shorten it because in the interest of time, I mean, he has done a lot of work in psychiatry. So, Dr. McLaughlin, with all due respect, I'm just going to give an abridged version. You received your MBBS medical degree from UWE, having trained in both Jamaica and Barbados. After a period of internship at the QEH in Barbados, you moved to the psychiatric hospital and began working in the field of psychiatry and engage in postgraduate training in the discipline, gaining the qualification of Doctor of Medicine in Psychiatry from the University of the West Indies. You spent most of your professional life engaged in clinical work at the psychiatric hospital and its outpatient and community services. And I'm very interested in hearing about those. And you've had brief working periods in the UK and throughout the Caribbean as a general psychiatrist. You currently, in your role as senior consultant psychiatrist, you work in an administrative role, which includes supervising the medical staff who work there. So I would imagine other psychiatrists, as well as providing clinical oversight to patient care at the institution. I think what is also important to state is that he also conducts civil and criminal forensic evaluations for clients, for law enforcement and legal authorities. You know, oftentimes people are charged for various crimes, but it is not that they are criminally minded. They may have a mental health illness. He recognizes that there is a lot of stigma associated with psychiatric facilities and mental health in general. And I love this part. He believes that mental health and mental well-being and the multidisciplinary treatment of mental illnesses are both important for our society in helping people to live happy and productive lives. At the end of the day, each and every one of us wants to be happy and to be productive. So, Dr. McLaughlin, I welcome you, and I would allow you to make any opening remarks before we get into the mental health matters, as the program is called.
Well, good afternoon to you, Tessa, and good afternoon to listeners. Hope you're hearing me well, and just want to thank you for the invitation to appear. As Tessa has said, you know, we go back a long way, certainly. And it is good to be reconnecting with her in a sense, in this way and in this manner. So I just look forward to our conversation, because I do know you have questions and things you want to find out. And we have talked a bit about stigma in the past, and I think part of the way of dealing with stigma is education and knowledge, and therefore as much information as I can provide, certainly, which will help people perhaps understand certain things, will perhaps go a long way to sort of demystifying and destigmatizing.
Okay. Just a technical matter. Your volume is very low. I don't know if it's the same for Oliver and listeners, but I am.
It does sound slightly low, and I do have him turned up to the highest. So maybe just speak a little closer to the microphone, sir.
I will move a little bit closer. Is that any better?
It sounds much better.
Yes.
Me.
Yes.
Okay.
I just wanted to hear that your voice, know that your voice resonates across the globe. Now, as I have said on each and every program, you know, especially given my love for language, there are many mental health matters to address, and our individual and collective mental health does matter. Even the need for psychiatrists to take care of themselves, right? Which is something we can talk about later. But can you give me some sense of your role as senior consultant psychiatrist? What is a typical day like for you?
Well, I will start by saying the senior consultant psychiatrist is actually, that designation is defined in law. The psychiatric hospital operates under the laws of Barbados, Cap 45, it's known as the Mental Health Act. And in it, it does define who the senior consultant is, and indicates that the senior consultant is a senior member of the medical staff in charge, essentially, of patient care. And so what that really involves is, and it's because when you are admitted or discharged from the psychiatric hospital, it actually is a legal matter. And it's a little bit different than from when perhaps you're being admitted into QEH, where you're not necessarily asked to sign anything to be admitted. You may be asked to sign things with regards to procedures and so on. But if you agree to be admitted into the psychiatric hospital, because we feel that you should be admitted, you actually have to sign a form that indicates you are willing to be admitted, and sign to say that you're willing to receive treatment. As you can imagine, we do have clients that do need to be admitted into hospital who are not willing to be admitted into hospital, but who need to. And so we have to have procedures that involve involuntary admission plans. And the law does define how that occurs. And the role of the senior consultant is really to have oversight and some responsibility for that process in making sure that it happens the way it's supposed to happen. And, you know, in as much as possible, ensure that the rights of the patients obviously are preserved. We do take depriving patients of their right to be walking, you know, around free. We take that very seriously in terms of bringing persons into hospital against their will. I do have, as you pointed out, I have a wonderful team of medical practitioners.
How many are they, if you don't mind me asking?
In total, we have 15.
15?
15, yes. So we have psychiatrists, so we have persons who are fully trained in psychiatry, And the topmost designation is consultant psychiatrist. I'm senior consultant, but we have consultant psychiatrists, and there are currently, say five, there's a bit of twist on that, but I'll say five consultant psychiatrists. And then we now have four senior registrars, and senior registrars are persons who have finished their training in psychiatry, but who are not yet in a consultant post, which is the post that's a little higher. And then we have others who are training in psychiatry, so they've gone through the training as I did, and at various stages in their training. And we have two medical practitioners who provide general practice services or physical medicine services to the hospital as well. As you may know, we have a pretty significant population of clients who are resident at the hospital. And yes, they have psychiatric illnesses and chronic mental conditions, but they also will have physical issues, you know, diabetes, high blood pressure, those sorts of things. And so we at the moment certainly have staff who we designated as providing care for those. All the psychiatrists obviously are medical practitioners in their own right. But certainly we recognize that some clients, you know, require a bit more physical or medical care than psychiatric care at this given point in time.
Okay.
Yes.
How does your role differ to that of Mr. Leacock, who is, I believe, the director?
Yes. Well, his role is administrative, certainly. And as you can imagine, the psychiatric hospital has a number of different departments. So doctors, and I have administrative responsibility for the doctors. Nursing has an administrator in charge there, but we have departments such as housekeeping and laundry and kitchen and all the things and all the departments that are necessary to have the hospital functioning. We have orderlies, we have drivers. And so Mr. Leacock is overall head of the department of the psychiatric hospital. And so really and truly is in charge of having all of these various departments or sub-departments or subsections sort of running and running well, because all of the departments obviously are quite important.
Okay. What has your, given your long history in this field, which is considered an inexact science, you know, we can pinpoint diabetes, we can pinpoint hypertension, we can pinpoint those chronic non-communicable diseases. But what has your journey been like in this discipline of psychiatry, especially in the public sector?
And I will say, and I will focus on that briefly, on what you just asked about the inexact science part of it, because it is something I think that those of us who work in the field, you know, have some issues with, in terms of often trying to explain what is happening with clients. We aren't able to point to a high blood sugar or high blood pressure or an abnormal CAT scan or, you know, something like that, in terms of assisting patients and their relatives in understanding exactly what is going on. But in the same way that, let's say, clients who have diabetes, yes, you have been diagnosed with diabetes, but it's sometimes not just a matter of taking a pill or a matter of taking insulin. You sometimes have to combine other things, including sometimes mental health interventions, in order to get adequate and better control of that condition. And even when we're describing mental health, and again, when we make diagnoses, which we can, and it's easier in some instances to make diagnoses than other times. But the important thing is then, what do you do with that diagnosis in terms of designing a treatment plan? And I think what's gratifying, as certainly as a physician, with regards to mental health, is when we see clients, and these are usually clients, again, some of whom have psychotic illnesses, some of whom are depressed or anxious, and we prescribe treatment, various modalities, and we see the improvement. So in the same way diabetics get better, persons with high blood pressure get better, we certainly see improvements as well with clients, which is quite rewarding. So over the years, what has occurred, and having just said that, I will say, we have seen, in terms of medications to treat mental health, we have seen certainly that there have been improvements in those. There's a wide variety of those. We have some certainly that have less side effects than some of the ones we'd have had 30 sort of years ago. Because some of the side effects were what concerned persons when they took the medications. If they agreed to take the medications, there were side effects which really made it obvious sometimes that they were taking these medications and that created problems. And we now have medications which certainly if persons take, then they're less likely to have those kinds of side effects.
Okay.
Improvement in our community services. When I would have started out, we would have had one community psychiatrist, and that has certainly blossomed to three. We would have had, and I don't know how many community mental health nurses, but—
Dr. McLaughlin, sorry to interrupt. I just got a message from a lovely lady, happens to be my mom. She says, your tone is very low. So I don't know if your volume button is low, or maybe you just need to project.
Okay, right, project a little bit more.
Thank you, I'm sorry to interrupt.
That's okay.
Right, I know you're now coming across loudly.
Okay, I'm not even sure I did anything. So as I was saying, if that's still okay, that's better?
Much better.
Okay, just shift it a little bit. So as I was saying, in terms of our community mental health services, we've increased the number of psychiatrists. We have increased the number of community mental health nurses as well. And certainly, and you know, we've talked about stigma in terms of the hospital itself. And having services in the community has really and truly made access to care a lot more palatable for persons. Having even said that, I think over the years we have recognized that I think stigma is generally less than it was before. I think there's a lot more awareness of mental health, mental illness, and I think persons, because of that awareness, I think are less stigmatized about it. I think there's been an increasing recognition of the role of those professionals, those mental health professionals, other than psychiatrists. And I think that has been really very positive as well.
Okay. In an effort to destigmatize the core mandate of the psychiatric hospital, why are patients sent there for, you have inpatient and you have outpatient care? So for the benefit of the public, could you explain why somebody would be assessed and discharged, or why they might have to be resident? And also, I want to hear a little more about the role of community mental health nurses in terms of their outreach, and how is that being facilitated at this time of COVID?
Okay. Persons are referred for an assessment with regards to mental health for a variety of reasons, but our concern usually when it comes to whether we admit someone or not is whether they are a danger to themselves or to someone else. And now, especially with COVID, I think that is, we focus very much on that. There are persons who can have conditions, let's say, you know, severe depression, that is associated with suicidal ideation. The person may have made a suicidal attempt, the person may want to make another suicidal attempt. And in that situation, it may be because of a lack of support on the outside, or the immediacy of the situation, we make a determination that it's best that the person comes in for hospital so that we can monitor them in that environment and provide whatever interventions are necessary so that they are no longer considering suicide. There are those persons with psychotic illnesses, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, who can become somewhat aggressive. They can have hallucinations. They can have ideas that persons are wanting to harm them. And they can be very impulsive, certainly very unpredictable in that situation. And they may pose a danger to others as well as themselves. And so a determination that we do need to admit them, and you know, in this case, admit them sometimes against their will, that's what we then certainly have to do. Other instances which are less than that, then persons will come for an assessment. We may start a program of treatment. We discuss with the client, we discuss with their relatives, and recognize that we can, or believe we can, manage the situation as an outpatient. And then that's what happens. And In many cases, our ideal is to manage cases as an outpatient, but sometimes the reality is such that, and sometimes the lack of social supports for some clients is such that we can't actually do that.
Okay.
If you go to the community,
Okay, go ahead.
So I was going to move on to the community mental health nurses. Our community services operate primarily out of the polyclinic system. So there are 9 polyclinics and there are 2 outpatient clinics, the St. Andrew Clinic in Belplaine, the St. Joseph outpatient clinic in Horse Hill. So there are polyclinics and those outpatient clinics, and our community nurses are attached to the polyclinics and the catchment areas that those polyclinics serve. I would have said we have an increase in community psychiatrists, and we have 3 community psychiatrists who are at consultant level. Obviously, there are more clinics than there are psychiatrists, and so the consultants will each have more than 1 polyclinic that they do attend and serve. But there are a lot more community mental health nurses, and their function is with the community consultants, and they do conduct actual clinics at the polyclinics, sometimes 1 or 2 per week. They will do assessments and conduct visits to persons in their homes in the community. The community mental health nurses are all mental health officers, and that is also a designation in law. And what happens is that a mental health officer can be called out to assess someone who is believed to have a mental health condition of a severity, and they can take steps which permit the police to take custody of that person and convey them to the psychiatric hospital.
All right, can I stop you one there for a minute? Because what you're saying resonates with me in terms of someone I know in a rural community who does have suicidal thoughts and a number of stressors in her life. So are you saying to me that this individual, this lady who is managing multiple roles, she can be seen by a community mental health nurse? Does she have to go to the polyclinic in Belplaine, or will the nurse come to her? How does it work, and what days are those community mental health nurses available? Well, let's take Belplaine and St. Andrew, okay? Because that is the geographical context.
Right, and I can speak generally and a little specifically, because there's a bit of an issue and will be a bit of an issue for a couple of weeks with Belplaine specifically, from a community consultant psychiatrist coverage, okay? The issue is, and imagine we do have persons who there is a belief they have a mental health condition, but who are unwilling to get or to seek help. And if it is that you're describing someone perhaps who is suicidal, then perhaps it's important that that help is sought or brought to them as soon as possible. So for someone in and again, St. Andrew and perhaps going to Belplaine, may be a possibility. Ideally, if the community nurse, if the person, let's say, is unwilling to go or can go, some of we have physically disabled persons, it was very difficult for them to get out.
So not only that, some people don't have access to a car.
Oh, exactly, all of that. So if contact is made with the assessment unit of the psychiatric hospital, and it is said, well, there's this person, we're concerned about their mental health, and can a community nurse come and see and assess, then that can certainly occur. And that will occur certainly, depending on how urgent it is. But again, it can occur certainly such that the community nurse will come out, obviously when they can, to see and assess that person. What can then happen is a discussion will take place with the community consultant psychiatrist or with myself with regards to what should be the next step. The next step is either going to be an arrangement for that person to go to that to the community clinic. And the Belplaine Clinic is every other week at this point in time in terms of the community consultant going.
Every other week?
Yes. So it may be that it's decided, you know, that perhaps it's going to be a bit too long depending on the circumstances. And so it's either one, that person may be offered an appointment at somewhere like the Morris Byatt Polyclinic, or two, it may be said, we'll arrange for you to come down to the psychiatric hospital and be seen there, because that can occur sometimes same day or the next day.
All right. And,
yes.
So let me ask you a question, because I'm trying to really keep it real based on things that I know and people I interact with. So what happens if I get a call at 2 a.m. from an individual who is suicidal, having suicidal thoughts, or at the end of their rope? What do I do? And which number do I call? I mean, I know it should not be ignored. I know it should not be taken lightly. But what do I do at 2 a.m?
At 2 a.m, I would recommend that you call the assessment unit.
And what's that number?
So to say 536-3091.
Okay.
Because the assessment unit is open 24 hours a day.
Okay.
7 days a week. So that's the number to call. If there's a belief that the person is going or has actually made an attempt at self-harm, then it's really a question of what supports are available in terms of family, neighbors, or whatever, who can either, you know, pick up this individual and either bring them to the hospital, the psychiatric hospital. If it is, let's say the person has taken an overdose of medication or whatever, we may recommend that person then goes to the QEH to then be medically cleared. If it is that the person is refusing to go and there is certainly a belief that that person is about to make a suicide attempt, then it may be that we will recommend the police be called so that the police can actually, unfortunately, have the person and then, if necessary, transport them either to us or to the QEH, as I said, depending on the physical or medical circumstances that might be in play.
Okay. Are police trained to, or is there a division trained? Because I would think that one would have to be very mindful about one's approach, a police appearing in uniform. Yes, you could have a very aggressive person, but are police trained to deal with these types of situations?
Police do receive some training, certainly, and the special forces certainly also, I know, do have some in PAMS training as well. But even if the officer is uncertain, then the officers will and often will call out the community mental health nurse and either seeking advice or seeking even the presence of that officer, you know, on site to assist in the situation.
Okay. Oliver, I was thinking maybe we should just play Marvin's song, if you don't mind. Just let's have a little.
Sure.
A happy moment, you know. Is that okay?
Your wish is my command, ma'am. Right. 29 minutes so after 3.
I just want callers to know that around 3:45, we will allow them to call in. But I just want to hear Marvin push and go through, something to that effect.
Never see so much obstacles before. I gotta pray some more. I gotta try and forget about it. I never say I'm perfect. And yes, I fall, but I'm gone again. See, my journey will never go in vain. No, no. And that's why I gotta push. We gotta push and go through. We gonna push. We gotta push and go through. We gonna push. We gonna push and go through all the way. Yeah, yeah. When my fire burns, you can see it from miles away. You come back to my jump, 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 jump.
My greatest concern is to not live in misery. So it's best I jump, cause we have a chemistry. I've been doing this long, long time. That's my remedy for peace of mind. And even if you stumble, just remain humble. I'm not ashamed to say that yes, I fall, but I'm gone again. See, my journey will never go in vain, oh no. Yes, I fall, but I'm gone again. See, this journey will never go in vain, oh no. That's how you gotta push. We gotta push and go through, gonna push. We gotta push and go through, gonna push. We gonna push and go through all the way, yeah, yeah.
I never see so much obstacles before.
Never.
I got to pray some more. I got to try it if I get a bone. So let me go back to my jam, 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 jam. So let me go back to my jam, 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 jam.
Thank you, and thank you, Oliver. I love that song because it's, when I first heard it, it spoke to me about pushing through, about dealing with obstacles, about staying strong, about, you know, being happy. It says a lot to me, and I specifically chose it because these matters are not easy to deal with. Especially by families coming to terms with the fact that loved ones have mental health challenges or illnesses. Dr. McLaughlin, what are your thoughts and what efforts can be made to destigmatize the words that we often hear in Barbados? Like, up to this week, somebody told me they have to go to the Green Gates. I hadn't heard that one before, but things like, you know, he or she mad, they're crazy, they're sick in the head, they gone to the mental, they at Black Rock, and now the Green Gates. I mean, I'm aware that efforts have been made over the years to improve the aesthetics of the psychiatric hospital, colors and plants and stuff like that, but yet, we still seem to have this battle in terms of accepting it as, like, as we do the QEH.
Yes, but I think those aesthetic changes, I think, you know, are going to help make a difference. The term Green Gates and Jenkins and all the other kind of terms that you hear for the psychiatric hospital are older terms. And I don't think you're hearing them quite as much now. And I think the generation of persons who would have used those terms is passing. And I think with the greater awareness that I was referring to earlier, I think there's less of a tendency then to use those sorts of terms to describe the hospital. And my expectation is that over a period of time, we won't be finding persons who are going to be using those terms to describe the hospital. But there's still a cadre of people out there who have stories and who hear stories about the hospital, which has been around for obviously quite a long time. I think education as well is going to change the terms of, you know, like mad and crazy and so on. And in terms of mad, we will probably start using terms like psychotic, you know, which is the kind of terms that you know, we're using clinically, but which will probably come into common day language. And, you know, rather than referring to people as crazy, we refer to them as mentally ill, mentally disturbed, mental health disorders, or psychiatric illness, terms like that. So I think the more we use those terms and use them in public spaces, then I think persons will start adopting and understanding those terms and then adopting them as well. Right now, perhaps for some people, the only language they have to describe what they see with someone in the throes of a psychotic illness is mad. And that's all words, you know, that they know.
Right.
So I do think the aesthetics, and just to make a point, because certainly the hospital obviously has a look because it's been around for such a long period of time. as refurbishment and renovations have gone on, the look of the hospital has really and truly started to change. I cringe every time I hear sometimes people referring to the hospital rooms as cells, because, you know, we think of them as rooms, but, you know, there's a reality, and, you know, people look at them and see them as how they look. But as time goes on as well, I'm expecting that because it will look differently, then I think the attitude that people will have, you know, along with other things as well, but the look is also important, those aesthetic changes that you referred to.
Okay. Now, in terms of mental illness, generally speaking, it falls on a spectrum in terms of its severity, from prolonged sadness to depression to an anxiety to chronic depression. You mentioned bipolar disorder, there's 1 and 2, borderline personality disorder, schizoaffective disorder. I remember once doing a course, Psychology 101, and hearing about, you know, the spectrum that went from sort of being well to being psychotic, right? Psychotic being the worst stage. And this is way back in university. So my question to you is, how do psychiatrists under your supervision determine individualized treatment plans or what are known as treatment modalities based on those illnesses? Because it can't be a one size fits all.
Well, exactly. But remember what I would have said at the beginning. The staff at the hospital are either fully trained psychiatrists or psychiatrists in training. And the ones in training, you know, reach out to the ones who are fully trained, myself included, because the fully trained ones will cover certain areas, and I still cover some clinical areas, and discuss cases and how we should manage. Because they're trained, then obviously certain conditions are treated in a certain way when it comes to medication and when it comes sometimes to psychological and other approaches. And as we discussed, as I said earlier, we certainly have increased number of medications than before. And so choice of medications then is about efficacy, but it's also about minimizing side effects. And so when one is dealing with a particular patient, for example, there's some patients, if they're diabetic, then it's some medications that we may decide we will not use, because some medications do have an effect on blood sugar. So one has to then, one, you know, makes the diagnosis, one is aware of what then is the usual treatment for that condition. One institutes treatment, whether it's, again, medical or medication treatment, and then a referral to other members of the multidisciplinary team when appropriate and as necessary, to deal with some of the psychosocial issues that have arisen or that are present and that are associated with the diagnosis. And so because our inpatient units, for example, especially our acute inpatient units, are all headed by a consultant who then has one or two of the certainly more junior doctors working with them, then usually there is a sit down with those doctors and then a sit down with other members of the multidisciplinary team in looking at what's the diagnosis and what are the associated psychosocial factors on board. So some people may have financial difficulties that require referral to a social worker. Some may have some, you know, residual issues related to trauma or childhood circumstances that require referral to a psychologist. And as you perhaps hinted, that we can all have a diagnosis. So we can have several persons with a diagnosis of, let's say, schizophrenia, but it can present differently. And the symptoms of concern may be very different for each individual patient. And so one is then going to, again, it's an individualized treatment to deal with that, but also deal with what are the social supports that the client has. Is this client living on their own? Are they living with a family? Are family supportive? Are family not supportive? And that factors as well into what you're going to be doing as far as, you know, having a treatment plan is concerned.
Okay. By the way, what is the capacity of the psychiatric hospital?
I'm not sure how to answer that. It, we
I mean, what's the maximum number of patients, inpatients, patients who are residential patients that you can cope with?
Okay, well, what I would say is that for a long period of time, we had around 530 patients. We actually have under 500 now. And in years past,
500 now?
Yes, wow. under 500 now. Many of those are long stay patients. And in the past and in the distant past, we have reached 600, high 600s before. That's a good few years now. Because of our community services, we have been able to get clients out and keep them out.
Right.
Because we now have, obviously psychiatrists out and we have community nurses who can visit or that they can attend the polyclinic. So that is kind of the determination in terms of why we can cut down on the number of inpatients that we have, which is desirable for a number of reasons.
Right. So those people who are like have family support are posing no harm to themselves or to others, they are best managed outside to alleviate the burden.
Exactly. But that family support is an important one, and sometimes is very absent for some clients.
Right.
And that creates difficulties for clients who can't then live on their own and manage on their own.
Right. Now, I have a difficult question or scenario to pose. It's very real. I shan't call any names, of course, but I'm familiar with the case of a mature woman who had early stage Alzheimer's compounded by other medical issues. You referred to diabetes and other things and the need to manage these, what you call them, comorbidities.
Yeah.
But she was jostled between the psychiatric hospital and the QH and deemed to have poor mental health. Without calling names, it is the family's belief that her doctor dropped the ball. And she actually died after being sedated for 12 hours. I really don't wish to criticize any institution. I know we are in an extremely tough time with COVID and with resources, human and otherwise, being stretched. But this lady was sedated for 12 hours, was brought home by the ambulance from the QH, and died shortly thereafter. There's a part of me that feels that the poor, the voiceless, and those who cannot articulate their needs may not receive the best care. No one called to say why the lady was being returned home. No doctor called. A call was just received saying, the ambulance is on its way. But something was fundamentally flawed here between two institutions. She's now dead. How do you respond to this? And I'm not putting you on the spot but I'm just saying, like, we know it's COVID. We know people don't want to touch and people are reluctant and doctors themselves don't want to get COVID. But this person had early stage Alzheimer's, and I do believe she could be alive today.
You said something at the beginning of that account, which spoke to, I think, multiple, maybe medical conditions. It would be interesting, I guess, to know what those medical conditions were and their severity. If it is this individual will come to certain QEH and then there was a discussion with our services, then one of the things we would have had an interest in was, would be what are those conditions and how severe they are, because it then dictates where is the better place for that person to be treated. Yes, we have medical doctors working in the hospital, in our hospital, but there are some things that require more specialist intervention than we can provide. And as it is, we do refer quite a number of patients to QEH when that is necessary. I'm not familiar with this particular case. My sense perhaps is that would have been where there would have been concern that the medical circumstances of this client were really and truly the concern, especially if it is that those medical circumstances were aggravating her pre-existing diagnosis of Alzheimer's, which is dementia, and whether or not, you know, those conditions were aggravating her dementia and making her a bit more difficult to manage. I can't comment on someone who's been sedated for either that long, then sent home.
Yeah, 12 hours from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m.
Okay. And again, whoever would have decided to do that again, perhaps, or hopefully would have had monitoring occurring for that person in that situation. But it sounds as if, again, perhaps in sending the person home, whether or not there wasn't a, as you said, a clear discussion with the relatives, or maybe there wasn't a discussion with the relatives, but the relatives didn't quite understand the be all and the end all of that situation. So that is really, really quite unfortunate. And, you know, obviously you do need to learn from that situation with regards to being clear as to what the concerns were in either institution. But I think if the patient is being sent home, then, you know, what would be the expectation of relatives in that situation to monitor or to deal with that client?
Yeah, well, it was particularly made more difficult because of the fact that the husband couldn't even visit his wife because of COVID. Yeah. There would just be calls, bring this, bring that, she needs this, she needs that. But there were mental health issues combined with medical issues that were ignored. And the individual, the relative is even speaking to me right now saying, you know, they were really turned around by both the psychiatric and the QEH. And, you know, the family is still at a loss as to why this lady should be alive, and that no doctor called to give any instructions, just the ambulance saying, we are about to bring your loved one home. And that was it.
And that is certainly is unfortunate. For those of us who work in the hospital, and therefore we work in the public service, and at the end of the day, it is, you know, the public of Barbados who, through their taxes or otherwise, you know, pay for us. And therefore, it is important that, you know, we are as respectful as we can be when we are offering care to those clients and their relatives. So I you know, without further information, it's kind of difficult to come in. As you said, COVID has, you know, does create difficulties in terms of both admitting bed space and in terms of having loved ones come in and be part perhaps of a face-to-face discussion with regards to what's necessary. And, you know, one can make calls on a telephone and, you know, things get lost, you know, they're not quite as well communicated. So, I do think there are other things that went on there, and that is really an unfortunate situation.
Okay, maybe we can speak about it privately. Okay. Before I go to So Happy by Skang Young, I just want to ask you, what tips or advice would you give to listeners about maintaining good mental wellness and self-care? What do we need to do? I'm getting some vibes from Oliver that there are callers backing up, but I definitely want to ask you that question about good mental wellness and self-care.
I think I heard a bit of your discussion with Dr. Emmanuel last week with regards to that, and what stuck out with me was the subject of exercise. Yeah. And I remember it was a few years ago, I was doing some research for a presentation, and it was on the subject of exercise. And I was surprised at the amount of literature that there is out there with regards to the benefits of exercise on mental health. And this is for persons, obviously, who don't have a mental health diagnosis. But even for persons who do, persons who are depressed, anxious, psychotic, substance abusers, and even those with dementia and Alzheimer's, as we mentioned earlier, that exercise has a clear benefit in, you know, improving persons' mental health as a result of it. And of course, we know about the benefits of mental health and physical health as well. So certainly I recommend exercise as being one of the things that we all should be doing. The pandemic would have led to situations where persons could not perhaps exercise in ways that they used to. Many of us would have put on weight and become a little bit less healthy as a result. And it is important that we get back into exercise programs. The Ministry of Health has, for the past few Fridays, been doing what's called a sneaker day. So on Fridays, it's had persons wearing sneakers to work.
Oh, nice.
With an understanding that if you're at work, then, you know, you've perhaps been doing a bit more moving about. Now, I work at the hospital, which is a fairly large campus, and I certainly found when I put on my sneakers, I have felt more inclined to walk and more inclined to walk briskly. And so, again, it got me thinking certainly about what are the barriers that we, you know, still have perhaps to exercising. I know certainly persons who enjoy and love to exercise. I do believe that they get, you know, special thrill out of doing that. I think many of us perhaps don't, but the importance is still there to do it. And we therefore have to find a way of exercising.
But and maintain and even going to the beach and swimming and being in open spaces.
There you go. Wide open spaces. And the beach is wonderful in terms of the visuals as well. Clear blue waters and the sand. And that is certainly a you know, pleasant imagery, certainly, which can be quite stress relieving in and of itself. But then, yes, you have the ability to run, jog, play games on the sand, or to go and swim and, you know, have an aerobic sort of workout as well by swimming as well. Sports in general, you know, being, well, you know, they have to be of a certain age or whatever to play sports. But dancing is actually, yeah. And again, now certain places are opening up and we can do a little bit more of that when we're socially distant.
Right.
But dancing, both fun and is, you know, you get a bit of, you get an aerobic workout as well. Engaging in hobbies, you know, things that persons like to do. And we're all very different in terms of what we want to do, whether or not we vegetate in front of the television, whether or not some people write, some people paint. I have friends who paint and who write books and all of these things, because it's part of a creative process. You know, persons can also, you know, from their work, if you enjoy your work, then actually work can also be quite useful for one's mental health. Some people don't enjoy their work and are only doing it for the paycheck, and therefore have to find other outlets, find other activities in terms of things right. to do that make them feel good, in which they are, you know, enjoy what they're doing and perhaps are being creative as well. Socializing, and, you know, that has obviously been a big issue in terms of COVID. But socializing is important. It's important for children. It's important for adults. And we're getting to do more and more of that as we are, you know, coming a little bit out of this pandemic. But it is important, certainly, that we have groups and persons, you know, that we can just kind of hang and talk with.
Right.
And yes. So I think those are some of the things that I would advocate are being useful for men.
Okay. Just a little thought that came to my mind. When I lived in Toronto, I worked for the Black Coalition for AIDS Prevention. And actually in Toronto, we were allowed to have a mental health day. There were times because you want to avoid burnout, and it was quite acceptable to ask for a mental health day. And that's something I think we need to start considering. In Barbados, not a day to go shopping, not a day to you know, go to doctor's appointments, but just a day to just remove yourself from the reality and to take care of yourself. Oliver, I don't know, we may have to go over time. I don't know how practical that is, but let's entertain the callers now, please.
Good afternoon. Welcome to
Mental Health Matters. Good evening. How is everybody doing?
We're doing great. How are you doing, ma'am?
I'm blessed and favored.
Thank you.
I just want to say I had some issues going on with me friend until I was 16 years old, and I was recommended to a psychiatrist, and she really helped me to work through my problems. I had a problem with some of the issues, and apparently I went to a clinic, and they just went up to this young lady and asked her if she's these people at the clinic that come in and do a program where they really have someone that to help you with your nutrition and stuff like that. And I asked her if she's a nutritionist, and she told me yes, and I started seeing her, and I was able to get the issues controlled, and I was able to get over my anxiousness. But I just want to any young person, any young woman or young man that's going through problems, prayer do help, because I was baptized in March, and I have a strong support from my family and my church group. My brothers and sisters in Christ, I have a strong support. I was saved by the power of God, and I know He said by His stripes we're healed, and I know that God can do anything. There's nothing too hard that God can do. If you believe, you shall receive. And I was able to write down my strength and my weaknesses, and every now and then I look at my strength and my weakness, and I know I'm a powerful woman of God, and I'm a corporate leader. I'm a corporate woman. I'm a champion. So I just want to say that the psychiatrist and the doctors was very helpful to me, because when I go through my issues, and sometimes when I call, I always get somebody at the other end that is willing to help me and tell me that Beverly, you are very intelligent, and they usually go to hospital, don't usually have to stay. They're just giving me my meds, and they just take my meds, and they just follow the regular regime. That's all they want to say. And thanks for having this program. I really appreciate VOB. Good evening to you, Mr. Oliver. Thanks to me and my friend, and may God continue to bless all your daughters and psychiatrists of the Queen Elizabeth Hospital and the Psychiatric Hospital. Good evening to Mr. Aline.
Good evening, ma'am. Thank you so much for your contribution.
Thank you. God bless you all richly.
Thank you. Well, that was certainly a success story that really lifts my heart.
Yes.
Oliver, over to you.
Good evening and welcome to Mental Health Matters.
Hello, good evening.
Oliver, are they...
I'm sorry.
Hi, good evening, welcome.
Hello, good evening. Well, I was a patient.
Yes, we're hearing you.
Yes, I was a patient at the psychiatric hospital. I was given a big dose, and when the nurses said to me, that is too much for me. Now, all they tell the doctors and the nurses, they would not answer me nor pay me no money. But I am off of all of my medication, focus, doing my budget, going to the beach, and doing my ministry. I know Satan is a liar. And you cannot, just like you cannot be a beacon if your light don't shine, you cannot be a nurse or a doctor if you don't have love. Because once you ain't got love, you ain't gonna got patience. You ain't got patience with people, but you can't deal with them. So the only fool in the South.
Okay, ma'am, thank you so much for your contribution.
Any callers?
Unfortunately, no more callers at this time.
I think we're having some technical glitches with the callers, but
there is another caller. Unfortunately, okay. we've missed them. And we do have some more calls coming in. Let's say good evening. Good evening. Welcome to Mental Health
Matters.
Let
me lower my radio. Let me lower the radio, please. Yes. Could I be able for you at least call me back off at the convenience time?
I'm sorry? You're live on air, ma'am? Sorry?
Would you be able to call me up on your convenience time off air?
We can hear you.
I don't want to be on air. Would you be able to call me back?
Sure, no problem. Let me take you off air, ma'am.
I'm not understanding the lady's question.
Okay, it seems as though the lady would like us to give her a call after the program. I do have her name and number. We have one more caller as we say good evening and welcome to Mental Health Matters.
Good evening to everyone.
Good evening.
Yes.
Hello, Miss Undecided.
How are you today?
I'm well.
Okay. I have about three questions. What happens during a psychiatric evaluation? And what questions does a psychiatrist ask the psychiatric, right? How many psychiatric and psychiatrists have mental health issues in Barbados? And how can a psychiatrist tell if someone has a mental issue? You have that?
Dr. McLaughlin?
Okay. Yes, interesting. Right, so with regards to a psychiatric evaluation, the reasons for that evaluation, because the way in which that's going to proceed is likely going to depend on what is the purpose of that evaluation. And more often than not, if a psychiatrist is doing the evaluation, then the expectation is they will have an interview with the person who is being evaluated, and there'll be a lot of questions asked. In some instances, information will be received from family members. That will depend on whether or not the person perhaps gives permission for that to happen. But you get information from the family members as well, and relevant information to why the evaluation is being done. And then it will be, because some of the information that's taken is also going to involve medical information. So the persons have past illnesses, either psychiatric or medical. And in some instances as well, once all the questions have been asked, that it may be that one will proceed to some physical examination as well as taking a blood test and doing some imaging. So it really will depend, I think, on why the evaluation is being performed, for what purpose, as to then sort of all the steps that are taken in terms of coming to an, I'll call an assessment, because an assessment is about diagnosis as well as all the associated factors that surround that. I certainly cannot answer how many persons who are mental health professionals have psychiatric issues, because that would be personal to them.
Can I just interject for a minute, just to let Ms. Undecided know that there are people who will choose to get help overseas. They don't want to be identified.
There's that as well. And, you know, certainly that's the right of persons to determine how they wish to access care. Especially if they need to access care, then it's important that they access care however they can. And so a determination as to whether or not someone has an illness then will depend on the findings of that evaluation. Remember, that evaluation starts somewhere. It may have been that persons were acting strangely, behaving strangely. It may have been that they were saying things that were unusual. And it may have been that they were doing things were very unusual as well. And when one does an interview, one then, you know, judges what's, you know, the response is. And as I said, one can then determine we're going to do a medical examination to rule out physical or medical causes for behavior, which has perhaps been deemed to be, you know, not reasonable. And you put all of that together, and certainly there are mental health disorders that have been described, and you know, one can fit the findings of an evaluation, and sometimes one can fit that to a known disorder, because all the known disorders, you know, do have descriptions as to what the presenting findings are going to be. I hope that answers.
Ms. Undecided, does that answer your questions?
Unfortunately, she is gone, but I'm very sure there was a lot of helpful information from Dr. McLaughlin. Thank you, sir.
Any more callers?
Good evening and welcome to Mental Health Matters. You're live on air. Good evening.
Peace be on to each and everyone. Ms. Jonathan Shaw, congratulations to you on your position, and I pray and hope that fairness will prevail. What I call to speak about, you know, I heard you and you like me speak about the elderly person that has passed away. I am very emotional and I feel this thing would take me to my grave. I lose young and especially old. I love the elderly, and I had a very close friend. I had loved that lady, and she died with COVID. And you know, when you say these things, people are saying you are not speaking the truth. But it's so sad. After these persons worked so hard, and as you said, everybody's scared because of COVID. They cannot see a family, and some of them die alone. Nobody to the bedside to hold a hand, to say a word before they get a last breath. And it really, really, really hurts. And it has me very emotional, especially when I hear the ages from 70 to 90-something, sometimes 100, and die from COVID. I remember my friends, and it's very, very painful to see the die alone and no one there to be, to, you know, at the bedside. And that's what have me daily. Thank you very much. Stay safe. Can you continue to keep the good work up? I hope this program will continue as long as it can, because we'll be able to speak on our emotions. Thank you. God bless you all.
Thank you. Just let me say to that last caller, I feel your pain as well, because I have a very close friend who his wife was never able to say goodbye to him. There has never been any closure. He was actually my deputy. In fact, the very first program, it was in honor of him, but there was never any closure. And I fully understand. Oliver, if you could just announce the number for callers.
Certainly, ma'am. 7 minutes after 4 o'clock now. The number to call is 434-1790. 434-1790. We do have some callers. As we say, good afternoon and welcome to Mental Health Matters. Good evening. Welcome to Mental Health Matters.
Good evening, Oliver. This is Anthony Hope calling.
Good evening, sir.
Good evening, too. I don't remember the names, pardon me. However, questions I want to ask. One, about infantile schizophrenia or childhood schizophrenia in terms of the development and the behavioral systems that would be set up. And most importantly, I want to ask this question because I'm not getting any clear entrance whenever I hear speakers. Is it accepted that a care provider in terms of schizophrenic behavior must risk their life in terms of getting to engage a person who's exhibiting psychotic behavior? Or will there be, or are there, or will there be provisions made in terms of backup to support and minimize the risk of the life of a mental health care provider? You can answer whichever one first.
Okay. Thank you, Paula, for that question, for those questions. Childhood schizophrenia occurs in circumstances where one sees the development of schizophrenia, and we'll come to that in a little bit, but occurring, obviously, in a person younger than the age at which we expect that to happen. Schizophrenia, in general, is a disease that does start to affect young adults. Adults in their late adolescence. But you can't start to see some of the symptoms, unfortunately, in young people, and young people even in primary school. And when that happens, one often will see the child becoming more and more withdrawn. The child perhaps will start behaving somewhat oddly and strangely in terms of dress and in terms of mannerisms. In terms of speech, and unfortunately, the child may develop then the core symptoms of schizophrenia, which will include hallucinations, and may develop delusional ideas as well, in which they start experiencing or having thoughts that persons are talking about them, ridiculing them, and that persons may in fact even want to harm them. And obviously, if that starts to occur in childhood, then it means that the child is going to have a long course of illness, and the normal development that a child is going to have through their adolescence, then it's going to be unfortunately interrupted. I hope that's useful. The treatment is going to be much the same as will occur in an adult with schizophrenia as well. But as I said, it's a lot more challenging when it starts very young. With regards to care providers of persons with schizophrenia, one of the things that's important for family members, if you have someone who's been diagnosed with schizophrenia, but you also know that part of that schizophrenic illness is that the person can become, you know, agitated, aggressive even, it's important, one, to ensure that that client is taking the medications and is having their follow-up. And if that becomes an issue, then whoever is providing care for that individual, then you do need to inform. If the person does become aggressive, we don't recommend the calling of police in terms of dealing with the aggression. In some instances, I know people sometimes have neighbors or family, and family get together and come in the sort of stage of physical intervention. But it may be that you have to call the police, and maybe then you have to call either the nurse or the psychiatrist associated with that patient, or call the assessment unit to get some further advice as to what to do. But obviously we would want that, you don't get to the stage where the person becomes unwell. So that's monitoring and ensuring that, the person is taking the medication, avoiding substances, alcohol and marijuana and so on. And again, if one recognizes that there are problems developing, try to nip them in the bud early. But if it really becomes a dangerous situation, then no, we expect that, the police will be contacted and the hospital will be contacted as well.
Okay. Caller, did we answer your question or has he left?
Unfortunately, the caller has left.
Okay. I received a question from a listener. And it says this: please ask what the hospital is doing to reduce the time spent before a restless or an unwell outpatient mental patient is examined. 5 hours plus is too long. This is a fact. We experience this on several visits. So this is an individual who had a family member and they had to wait an awfully long time at the psychiatric hospital. This is an outpatient mentally ill person, and they were waiting 5 hours or longer for care.
Right, and so my assumption is that that person perhaps had come to the assessment unit to be seen, because all clients who are presenting to the hospital in an urgent or an acute way will go to the assessment unit. The assessment unit, for those who have been there, is a rather small unit. And while it is open all the time, it cannot be first come, first served, because it in many ways behaves like the QEH's accident and emergency department, which is if something urgent comes in, then it means that that is going to then take precedence. So if, a very aggressive patient comes in, and we therefore need to take some action to get that person into an environment in which that person is safe and persons around them are safe, then that will certainly then take priority. Depending on the time that persons present to the assessment unit, there may be only one doctor because it may be an on-call situation. The doctor sometimes is dealing with a situation I've just described, or may even have to be with a medical emergency somewhere. So I'm not quite sure what to then say. I don't know if the person alerted nursing staff, who are usually there to sort of say, well, the situation is getting a little bit, a little bit worse. The person is becoming a little bit more agitated. In some instances, there are ways to calm the person down while they're waiting to be definitively seen. But it's not our intention to have people waiting for long periods of time. Unfortunately, the circumstances Because sometimes, especially on weekends, the assessment unit can get really quite busy and quite a lot of people waiting to be seen.
Okay, thanks. Oliver, there are a few callers who are trying to get through, but they're telling me there's no answer. I don't know why. I know we've gone over time.
Okay, let's try another one. Voice of Barbados, good evening.
Hi, good evening. I'm calling about the same waiting. I want to talk to the doctor because you have the situation where you try to approach the nurses. You try to let them know this young lady is quite restless. She's agitated, but it makes no difference. And I can tell you, because I've experienced this going with a family member, I can tell you it has happened repeatedly. That's why my question now is, what is the hospital doing about that? And I'm saying, if those at the higher level are not aware of it, then they need to do some mystery shopping, meaning you need to go among the masses and see what is going on. Because I got involved because of this same thing. You can't have a restless patient sit there and you're trying as a layman to comfort and calm the patient down. And you know, don't try to talk to the nurses because they see you as being a bother. So I'm just saying, what is the hospital doing about this? And if they're not aware of it, I am making it public and making them aware of it now because it is something that needs to be addressed.
Thank you, caller. Dr. McLachlan, any responses?
Sure. I would say thank you very much, caller. Because they're now obviously two persons who are sort of making statements, you know, that this is occurring. And what I shall do certainly is do my own investigating with regards to that and have a discussion with staff about this, because this is obviously something that is creating concern. And we can certainly look at ways to deal with the situation. So yes, it's now been brought to my awareness and I can take some action in terms of speaking with the staff involved.
Thank you. Oliver, I know we've exceeded our time. I have to be guided by you. There is one question I want to ask Dr. McLachlan, but I don't know if there are other callers because clearly there's a need for information. There's a need for clarification. So
no other callers at this time. No other callers. No, ma'am.
Okay. So Dr. McLachlan, here's my final question to you. If you had a magic wand, and money was not an object, what types of mental health services would you want to see developed in Barbados? If you had a magic wand, and what do we really need?
I
don't hold back. I know you're a public servant, but just, you know, I understand. But if you had that lovely magic wand.
I think what has happened, perhaps even with that last caller, has said to me that there are perhaps circumstances that the public are concerned about with regards to the delivery of services. And I think, you know, I might have ideas and senior management at the hospital might have ideas as to what we want to do. But I think it's important that the people that we serve, clients and their families, have a voice in terms of stating what it is that they would wish to see as well. I'm a little concerned about sort of thinking in terms of, well, just having lots of money and throwing it at somewhere. Because at the end of the day, I think if there is a need, then rather than wishing that we can do something about it, we should try perhaps to identify it as a goal and start thinking about how we can actually make it happen. And, you know, if there's money to be had somewhere to make it happen, then if we have identified it, then we can perhaps search for it. So I'm kind of avoided the question, but I actually do believe, you know, and I think it's important that we do have voices speaking to public health needs with regards to mental health. And I also think that, again, when we've identified what the needs are, that we, you know, as wide as possible in terms of determining how do we make them happen? How do we bring them to reality and not have them as just wishes?
Well, I would like to say that if I had a magic wand, I would like to see a highly specialized treatment facility to cater to all types of mental health challenges in a non-threatening, non-judgmental, rustic setting with all the specialists, doctors, psychiatrists, psychotherapists, people doing yoga, restoring people to mental health. I have seen it in large cosmopolitan cities. I would not situate it in Black Rock for sure. No offense to anyone living in Black Rock, but it would be in a rustic sort of setting overlooking the sea that is in and of itself calming and therapeutic and soothing. That would be my wish.
Remember, as psychiatrists, certainly we try to encourage people to connect with reality as much as possible. And what you just described certainly is something that sounds wonderful. So, you know, as you said, you know, you've seen it and I'm aware of facilities such as that overseas. Most of those are private, however, and there's a cost associated with going to them. But I think, and I'm not sure if it's on your show, where a caller did, you know, sort of suggest that something like that would be desirable. But you would want as many people as possible to benefit from it. So maybe again, we should not just be thinking of it in terms of fantasy, but, you know, is there a way to bring some aspect of that, if not all aspects, but some aspect of that?
Yeah, and I would want to have a sliding scale fee to accommodate the poor or and everybody in between. I wouldn't want to see a high end for the upper echelons of society. I would want to see something that is very inclusive and very supportive.
Okay, it's 22 minutes past 4 o'clock now. Just want to let you know there is one final comment from a caller who said she would like to see a lot more correlation between the QEH and the psychiatric hospital. That was the final comment of the caller.
Thank you for that. I'm sure Dr. McLaughlin will take note.
Yes.
Oliver, I would like to just say a few things before we close, and I would like to hear So Happy by Skung Young, because I want us to leave on a happy note. But I wish to thank Dr. Brian McLaughlin most sincerely for sharing your expertise and knowledge. Definitely to VOB for giving me 20 more minutes, and certainly to Lewis Drug Mart. I want the public to know that next week, we will start with, we are going to transition now to the role of psychologist, and our guest will be Dr. Deanne Ford, president of the Barbados Society of Psychology. So on that note, I leave listeners and I wish you a happy weekend. We have a holiday tomorrow. Be safe, take care of yourself, get some exercise. And self-care does not mean being selfish. You know, sometimes we get that a little confused. Self-care is about taking care of ourselves. It's very important. I will be going to the beach tomorrow for my own self-care. So Oliver, thank you. And can we hear So Happy by Skung Young?
We do love to party.